faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman.
If you're the right age, you may know all the words to the opening of the 1950s Superman TV show. But that's just one version of the 75-year-old character. In fact, a new Superman movie is due out next week. Despite all these reboots, the basic elements of Superman remain the same. An alien refugee endowed with tremendous strength and simple heroics. Today on Focus, we'll talk with journalist Larry Tai. He's the author of a book about the Superman phenomenon, now available in paperback. And we'll check in with the southern Illinois town of Metropolis, where an annual Superman festival opens today. The story of Superman coming up on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Superman is one of America's most enduring pop culture heroes, and in a few minutes we'll talk with author Larry Tai about the history behind the Man of Steel. But first, let's go to Metropolis. In the comics, Metropolis is a big city, suspiciously like New York, where Superman holds down his day job as a mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper. The real Metropolis is a small town of 6,500 people on the Ohio River in southern Illinois, but every June, they become Superman's Metropolis through the annual Superman Celebration. And Carla Ogle is co-chairman of the event, which opens today. Carla, great to have you with us on Focus.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How many years has the Superman Celebration been in Metropolis?
This is our 35th year.
Who had this idea?
You know, there were several business people that kind of got together with the idea, but the idea of actually being the hometown of Superman came mainly from a gentleman called Bob Westerfield. He realized that, Metropolis was the only metropolis with a zip code in the United States, and it was such a coincidence with the same name as the iconic character Superman. And he kind of rallied a group of people together, and they went to DC Comics, and they were able to get an agreement to be recognized as the hometown of Superman. They also went to the House of Representatives in Illinois and got something passed about that, too. But then they decided to go a step further, and they said, we need to have some type of a yearly festival. It started as just a little hometown, one day, tug of war with the fire and police department and just a couple people, serving up hamburgers, and it just expanded and expanded until now it is a four-day celebration. It brings people from all over the United States, all over the world, actually. We have people from other countries that come in. Everybody just loves the character Superman, so they all want to participate in this festival.
How many people do you expect to have?
We usually estimate between 30 to 40,000 people come in over the four-day period.
And this is a town of 6,500. I know you have some visitors because you have a riverboat casino, but if somebody was going to go there spur of the moment and was looking to stay overnight, would they be able to find a room?
We're very fortunate. We have several wonderful hotels in town. The Chamber of Commerce has been very good to kind of stay in contact with them to see if they have any open spots. So people call the Chamber, hey, where can I get a room? And they can kind of guide them toward which one may be available. But we're also next to Paducah, Kentucky, which have, quite a few hotels. So very close by. If you can't get a hotel in Metropolis, you're within a very close distance, within 12 miles, so you could definitely find some place to stay.
I was looking at the website, and I was struck by some of the activities you have. And one thing I understand that's grown a lot over the years is the costume competition, which started as a kids' event, but it's really grown beyond that, I take it.
It was really kind of funny because when I originally came on board to help out, I was in charge of the kids' tent before I became the chairman. And I put together a little kids' costume contest, and one year we had three adults that showed up, and we said, well, this is really for kids. And they said, well, can we at least get on stage? And we were like, sure. And so the next year we had more adults that showed up, and we're like, okay, we need to have a costume contest for the adults. And it just kind of snowballed, and we decided to have the first prize be $1,000, which is a huge amount that you could win. So these participants, they work all year long. And, in fact, after they watch the costume contest, they're already, before they leave Metropolis, before they leave town to go home, they're already discussing what they're going to work on for next year. So there is such a variety. And, you know, there's some store-bought costumes, but there's some that people have really put a lot of time and effort into, you know, to make these characters come to life.
And I know if you go to our Facebook page, Focus 580, you'll have find some pictures, I believe, that you sent up to us that we've put up, including some of the folks in costumes. I understand that one of the events is an event to break a Guinness Book of World Record record, which I believe was previously set at the Superman celebration for the number of people dressed as Superman appearing together.
Yes, we were the originators. We set the record in 2008, and I believe we had 128. And then it was broke twice after that. It had been held in Canada. A company, you know, got the outfits for all their employees, and they did it. And so we were gearing up for this, and we decided, you know, we need to bring it back to the hometown of Superman. And then we just found out yesterday that Sears in Chicago broke it. And so now we have an even higher number we have to come up with. I believe 566 was the number they were able to put together.
566 yes. People dressed as Superman.
Yes. So this is going to be very challenging for us. But you know what? I was talking to somebody this morning. I said the last two people that broke it, they were companies that had their employees dressed as Superman. This is Metropolis, home of Superman, so we're talking about the fans, the people that love the character. So everybody's very excited about this, and we've been having people contact us saying, you know, I've got my outfits, I'm bringing my kids, I'm bringing my neighbors, and, you know, we told everybody, bring you and your 10 of your closest friends, and, you know, it's very doable for us to actually get this record. It's going to be a huge number, a lot of people, but we're staying pretty positive.
Another event that struck my curiosity is the staging, and it reminds me of the real-life Brady Bunch production, which appeared in some city several years ago, but the staging of a 1950s Superman TV episode. This is not showing the old film of the episode, but you're actually going to have actors come up and do it on stage.
The Perils of Superman, and this is an example of the wonderful people that come to the celebration. We have so many what we call our regulars that have been coming for years and years and just really appreciate everything that the City Metropolis and the Chamber of Commerce does to put this on, and they want to participate and be a part of it. And several people have come to us and say, hey, we've got a great idea. You know, what do you think? And this gentleman, Keith Howard, had actually done one last year and got some great response from it. And I told him, I said, all right, we need to do this year. And so he took it, he ran with it. Last year they did an I Love Lucy episode where, you know, Superman appeared. So he's doing The Perils of Superman, all live actors. It's going to be on the stage at Baymont Theater, you know, down by the river. And they're doing, you know, costume. He's built set pieces. And then actually we have special guests that's going to be at the first performance on Friday. Lori Mitchell and Gregory Moffat are two actors that were in episodes of The Adventures of Superman, which is huge for us to be able to bring them in because, you know, that's from the 50s. And we're starting to kind of run out of actors that were, you know, in those episodes, the black and white TV series. So the two of them were so pleased to be able to come, and we're going to actually have them at, they're not going to be performing, but after that performance, they'll come up on the stage and they'll be able to talk to the audience and kind of give them some insight on what it was like to be around, you know, that era and work with, you know, one of the first guys that played Superman.
Now, I got to think now, despite the celebration every year, Metropolis is a normal small town, even though your weekly newspaper is called The Planet. I think people are having regular lives. They aren't necessarily huge Superman fans, but what sort of interaction has there been over the years between the Superman fans to come to this event and the townsfolk?
You know, it's kind of funny because every year we have several people that say, I love this town, I'm thinking about moving here. And actually, we have had a few people that did move here, you know, after coming to the celebration. You know, we're very much more like Smallville than we are the Metropolis of the movies. You know, we are a small town, you know, Midwest. So, you know, and yes, we do have a few Superman fanatics in town. But for the most part, you know, we just go about our regular business. But I have a florist in town. That's my day job. And I'm actually a block from the Superman statue on the square. And I could look out my front window and see the Superman statue anytime during the day. And I always get so tickled. I've lived here all my life. And so I'm just, this is just kind of a, it's a neat thing, but, you know, I can look out my front window and see all day long, nonstop, people walking up to the statue and posing beside of it and getting their pictures made. You know, driving down Interstate 24, we've got a big billboard, you know, sign on the highway that says giant Superman statue. And so a lot of times people will say, well, we got to see this. And they may not have intended to stop in Metropolis. They're going to somewhere else, but they curiosity gets the best of them. And they roll into town, and they're just always in awe. A lot of times, you know, I walk up there and talk to them, take their picture for them, and they're always like, oh, my gosh, we didn't know this existed. And then we tell them about the Superman celebration. And you know what? A big percentage of the time, they're like, we're going to plan on coming next year and bringing the family. So that's it's kind of a neat thing.
Well, the Superman celebration, which opens today, it runs through Sunday in Metropolis, Illinois. The website is supermancelebration.net. A lot of detailed information there about the festival. And you can also see pictures from the Superman celebration on the Focus 580 Facebook page. There's also one at our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Carla Ogle, best of luck with the Superman celebration this year. And thank you for being on Focus with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay, take care. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about Superman this hour. Besides the Superman celebration down in Metropolis, Superman is a global phenomenon ever since it was thought up by a couple of high school kids in Cleveland back in the 1930s. Journalist Larry Tighe grew up with Superman, as did a lot of folks, and it was an early influence that served him well when he wrote Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. That book is now available in a trade paperback edition from Random House. And Larry Tighe, welcome to Focus.
Good to be with you, Jim.
And were you at, I understand, were you at the Superman celebration last year?
I was. That was the official unveiling of my book. They were really wonderful. And it's nice when you can have 30,000 people get together and help you launch a new book.
So it was a fun event, I take it.
It was. To give you an example, though, of how remote Metropolis is and what it takes for people to get there, for me to get there from Boston meant taking a flight from Logan Airport to O'Hare in Chicago, waiting for one of the two puddle-jumping planes that every day goes from O'Hare to Paducah, Kentucky, and then having prearranged for somebody to come across the river to fetch me in Paducah and take me to Metropolis, because there are no taxis in Metropolis. And it's not easy for people to get there, and the idea that 30,000 of them do every year suggests the appeal that not just the festival has, but that Superman has.
It is, by the way, handy to I-24, so it's not too remote, Metropolis, Illinois.
No, it's not, except that people are coming from across the world to come there.
Well, I was wondering about the Superman phenomenon that sparked that particular festival. And, of course, Superman is a carefully managed character, and the people at DC Comics and Time Warner work hard to make sure he's a profitable character that the public wants to pay money for. But why does the public want him? Why has Superman endured 75 years?
So I think there are two reasons. One is I like to say that Superman, over those 75 years, has evolved more than the fruit fly. In the 1930s, when we were in the middle of the Great Depression, we needed a butt-kicking New Deal liberal, and that's what Superman was then. He was going after slumlords and wife beaters. In the 1940s, America was going to war, and Superman helped take us to war. He sold everything from war bonds to paper drives. A Superman comic was slipped into just about every ration kit that went to soldiers overseas, and he was really critical in that war effort. In the 50s, America was chasing the Reds, and Superman was looking for the communists along with the rest of America. In every era, including up to the present, he evolved to be a man of his times, and he just quit in the comic books the Daily Planet to go to work as a blogger as a sign of sort of, again, keeping up with the times. But at the same time that he was changing, even more critical to his success, he remained constant. He was the hero of the light. We had plenty of dark heroes like Batman, plenty of fraught heroes like Spider-Man, but Superman was the guy who instinctively knew the difference between right and wrong, and I think we're perpetually drawn back to that sense of goodness. It may sound clunky and old-fashioned, but it's reassuring and wonderfully familiar.
By the way, because we got a question in on our social media about Superman's costume, what is he wearing right now in the comic books?
Well, he has sort of startlingly, he was famous for wearing his underpants on the outside, and now he's starting to wear them on the inside. It is still red, white, and blue, red, white, and yellow, I'm sorry, and the, but even when they change these days something minor in his costume, fans, after 75 years, feel like they own the character, and DC Comics has heard about that, and a lot of people are wondering whether he'll revert back. Every change in Superman that you could imagine has happened at some point during the last 75 years, and every time the change didn't work for fans, he's reverted back to his original form.
Well, I can certainly note that Anthony Pizzelli, who contacted us from Milford, Connecticut, said, when will they return Superman back to his classic costume? I hate the new one. So that's one vote in that direction.
Well, tell Anthony just to wait, and it'll happen.
And if you have any questions or comments for Larry Tye about Superman, call in at 333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL, and you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Tell me about the creators of Superman, Jerome Siegel and Joe Shuster, the two men who created it, I guess, as teenagers, and maybe particularly Jerry Siegel, because it really seems to have been a heartfelt creation of his.
So we thought we knew the story of the creation of Superman, and yet in the course of researching my book, I came across an unpublished 150-page memoir by Jerry telling a story that was quite different than the one that most people had heard. And if you have a second, I'll just tell you the story because I think it says a lot about Superman's enduring appeal.
Definitely.
The story is that Jerry Siegel was a kid who grew up in a part of Cleveland called Glenville, and it was 70% Jewish, and it was a very insular community. And every day when Jerry was a teenager, when he would go out on the playground, the other kids would look at him and see a kid who was a little bit too short and a little bit too round and who wore glasses that were a little bit too thick. And they would taunt him. They would yell things like, "Seagull, seagull, birds of an eagle." Now, I have no idea what that means, but I know that if you're a little boy out on the playground and the boys are taunting you and the girls are watching them do it, you wish you could fly away. Jerry couldn't fly away, but what he could do is every night go to bed with a pencil and a paper and imagine stories that would help him fight back against the bullies. And the first story that he imagined was a character called the Super-Man. And this was a bad guy. It was a very strong hero, but it was sort of an anti-hero. It was exactly the kind of a character that a young kid would dream up to help him take on the bullies. And this is what Superman looked like for several years until when he turned 17, something very traumatic happened to Jerry. His dad, Michael Siegel, owned a haberdashery, an old used clothing store in a seedy part of Cleveland. And one day, two big guys came in and tried on a suit and walked out without paying. And Michael Siegel chased them out the door. And when he reached the threshold of the door of his store, he had a massive heart attack. He basically dropped dead. And suddenly Jerry, the youngest of six kids of Lithuanian Jewish immigrants, he was bereft. Jerry had lost his hero. He had lost his father. And shortly after that, he was 17 at the time, he goes to bed again with his pencil and paper, and he reimagines Superman. He drops the in front of super. He drops the hyphen between super and man, and he drops the bad guy act. And the next morning, he runs across the street to his artist buddy Joe Shuster's house, and the first drawing ever of this Superman story that Jerry had concocted shows a hero swooping in to save a man who looks a whole lot like Michael Siegel, who is being robbed. So when your listeners think of the Superman story, they shouldn't think of kids sitting down to dream up a character who would earn them $1 billion. They should think of a bullied and a bereft boy who needed a hero for his own life. And I think his need for a hero mirrored our need for a hero, and it's worked for 75 years.
You're talking about really a sense of urgency behind the creation of Superman, heartfelt urgency that you wouldn't necessarily get from some of the more fanciful depictions of him.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a little boy's need for also having the girls who are looking at him see not the short, round kid, but being able to see inside of him and see a superhero lying there. That was what this dual identity was all about, I think. It was Jerry's wanting us to see that he had a hero in him.
And this also connects, the depictions of Superman have always been strictly neutral in terms of what counts for neutrality in pop culture. But you make a case in your book about the Jewish influence on Superman. In what ways?
Sure. So I think that over time, every religion on the face of the earth has embraced Superman as theirs. What Christians see in the story is they see a character who looked a whole lot like Marlon Brando in the Christopher Reeve Superman movies, Superman's father, Jor-El, on a faraway planet. And Christians say, geez, this godlike character sent his only son down to Earth to show mankind that it could be better than it thought it could be. And there's an entire book written called The Gospel According to Superman. What Buddhists see is an extraordinarily Zen-like hero. They say, geez, who could be more Zen than this character who just always knows just what to do? Atheists and agnostics say, hold on a minute, who needs God or religion? This is the perfect secular Messiah. He knows instinctively what's right and what's wrong, and he does what's right. But I'm here to tell your listeners that Superman, in fact, I think is Jewish. And he's Jewish not just because his creators were Jews and his publishers were Jews. He's Jewish because the character that came down from the planet Krypton was known as Kal-El, which in Hebrew means the voice or the vessel of God. And I told you the story that Christians see in Superman's coming down to Earth. The story that Jews see is of parents who are trying to save their firstborn son. And the way they save him is they float him into outer space. He ends up in the middle of the American heartland, where he is adopted by two extraordinary Gentiles named John and Martha Kent. They raise this baby as their own, and they learn over time that it's quite an extraordinary child. And they see, in other words, the story of Moses or Exodus. But my most fun piece of evidence in terms of Superman's ethnic roots are any name that ends in the word M-A-N is one of two things. It is either a superhero or a Jew, or in this case, both. So when listeners see the word S-U-P-E-R-M-A-N, they should know it's not pronounced Superman, it's pronounced Superman.
Interesting. I'm wondering, because certainly a lot of Jewish folks have worked on Superman over the years. Has a Jewish actor ever portrayed Superman?
Has not. And the this is where we're making a break from tradition in the new Man of Steel movie that's about to come out and having a British actor portray Superman, but no Jewish actor has ever portrayed him. There were only a few actors over the years who have portrayed Superman, and there are only a few among those who have really made an impact. And the as we know, when I close my eyes and think of Superman, I think of the 1950s Superman, George Reeves, from the TV series. Another one who clearly made a big impact was Christopher Reeve. And what Warner Brothers is hoping is that this guy, Henry Cavill, who's going to play him in the new Man of Steel movie, will be around for as many movies, four of them, the way Christopher Reeve was.
One thing I was struck by in reading your book about Superman is that besides his creators, and Siegel and Shuster actually worked on the Superman comic books for its first few years, are or else worked had artists working for them in producing the feature, but that when Superman moved over into new artists or moved into other media, other people had strong had strong influences in developing the character. Some of the things they did would fade away when Superman moved in the new hands, but some things stuck. And for instance, the 1940s radio show, I understand, had some introduced some devices which stayed with Superman as the feature progressed.
It did. So one medium would have him just leaping high. That was the way he started out in comic books, and then he learned how to fly. One medium would have nothing that could make Superman at all vulnerable, and then another medium would introduce kryptonite. That whatever worked in one medium generally worked its way over into the rest of them. So radio did a lot of pioneering. TV gave us a new look. The animation, the movie serials, the full-length films, everybody added their own touch to it. And even something as basic as Superman's credo, which we think of as being truth, justice in the American way, it only started out with truth and justice, and it wasn't until we went to war and DC Comics hired a child psychologist to help coin the perfect term to express what our troops were fighting for that we added the American way to his motto.
I mentioned the radio show because I have a clip from the radio show ready to play now, and it's actually an excerpt from a serial that you spend some time writing about in your book, and that's The Clan of the Fiery Cross from 1946.
Yes. So that was an extraordinary series of shows that at a time when America as a whole was not really ready to take on the Ku Klux Klan, Superman on the radio did take on the Klan in a very direct way, partly making fun of the Klan, broadcasting their supposed passwords on the airwaves. And one of the ways that I think the radio producers of Superman understood that you could undermine an organization like the Klan was to have kids running around making fun of it. And supposedly, legend has it that the Grand Dragon came home one day to find his kids talking about secret Klan passwords that they had just heard in the Superman radio show, and the Grand Dragon was supposedly outraged and wondered who the traitor was in their midst.
The writers of Superman got hold of that sort of information?
They got hold of that information partly by a guy who had infiltrated the Klan, a man named Stetson Kennedy, who passed on to Robert Maxwell, the producer of the radio show, this information. But Maxwell was intent on his own. He understood that you could undermine it by showing just how evil it was having Superman take it on and beat the Klan.
Well, let me set up the clip. This is about a 95-second clip that we have from, I think, the climactic moment of the Klan of the Fiery Cross. And to set it up, I should note that the targets of the Klan organization in this serial are not blacks, they're not Jews. It's actually a Chinese American kid, a baseball player. In the setup, Jimmy Olsen and the Daily Planet editor Perry White have been investigating. The plot has thickened to the degree where members of the Klan of the Fiery Cross have kidnapped them. They're out of the woods. They are preparing for their execution, and we'll start from there.
Gee whiz, Mr. White, why does a swell country like the United States have to have outfits like the Klan of the Fiery Cross?
Every country has its lame brains and diseased minds, Jim. Germany had the Nazis. We've got the Klan of the Fiery Cross. No, I just hope our country realizes the danger of these lunatics in nightshirts before it's too late.
Well, still making one of your big speeches, eh, White? Well, save your breath. You've only got a short time left.
Why, you're a madman, Riggs. You'll go to the chair for this.
Don't make me laugh. I warned you. You couldn't stop the work of the Klan. Nobody can.
That's what you think.
I said nobody can stop us. We're going to get rid of every foreigner in this country. Everyone who thinks, acts, and looks different from us. Anybody who tries to stop us will get the same thing you're getting. Okay, boys, I see you.
Oh, the man's mad. Absolutely mad.
And we're through, Chief. This is it.
Harry!
Yeah, Matt?
As Grand Defender of the Klan of the Fiery Cross, you will now perform your sacred duty. Here's a gun. Take care of those two chink lovers.
Okay.
Here it comes, Mr. White.
Easy, Jim, easy.
All right, you dirty punks. Here's where you get yours.
You mean here's where you get yours? I'll take that gun, and you take this.
Superman, Jim!
Chief, it's Superman.
Thank heaven.
Hello, Jim. I'll just get these ropes off you and Mr. White.
Oh, thank heaven you've arrived just in time.
And how? Hey, look, the Klansmen are getting away. Go after them,
yes,
Superman.
Yes, these ropes can wait. Don't let them get away.
Don't you worry, they won't get far. There, you're free. All right, now get behind those trees in case there's any more shooting. I'll round up our friends in the sheets. Away!
And that's Bud Collier as Superman from that 1946 excerpt of Clan of the Fiery Cross. I like the way that Bud Collier always announced Superman's exits on the radio show. And I understand he also portrayed Superman in a lot of the animated TV cartoons from the 1960s and onwards.
Yes, he was really wonderful, and he didn't want to do the Superman. He had to be tricked into trying out for the Superman radio show. He ended up doing it for the entire run of the series, and he was quite brilliant because whereas George Reeves, who played him on TV, could never quite change the tone of his voice enough to convince you that Superman and Clark were really different people, Bud Collier could lower and raise his voice, and he really did. They initially thought they were going to need two actors to play him. Bud Collier was so good that he did it alone, and he was, I think, one of the best portrayals of Superman ever.
If you want to hear, actually, you can hear the entire Clan of the Fiery Cross serial on YouTube these days. It's 16 15-minute episodes, so about a four-hour story. We're going to take a short break right now on Focus. When we'll come back, we'll talk more with Larry Tye about Superman. Also be talking with the founder of the Super Museum down in Metropolis, Illinois. This is Focus on WYLL. Welcome back. This is Jim Meadows on Focus on WILL. My guest today is Larry Tye, author of Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. We're talking about Superman this hour. Earlier, we spoke with Carla Ogle down in Metropolis, Illinois, about the Superman celebration going on this weekend down there. But there's one Superman attraction in Metropolis that is open year-round, the Super Museum out on the Metropolis Town Square. Its website says it's open every day but Christmas. Jim Hambrick founded the museum. He's with us now. Jim, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
And how did you come to found the museum? First of all, how long have you had it open?
Since I was about 5 years old.
Really?
As a kid, I had my whole room decorated with Superman, and it was an easy way for me to collect a nickel here and a nickel there, and I would charge people to go through it and take a look at all the different things I had.
What sort of artifacts and objects do you specialize in?
Well, I mean, every category from radio show acetates to Adventures of Superman movie props and costumes and wardrobe to Christopher Reeve costumes and wardrobe and storyboards and things like that, but all original, all a lot of antiques, a lot of things relating to the World War II, a lot of tin wind-up toys and puzzles and games and life-size figures, you name it, we got it. Over 75,000 items on display.
Okay. How many visitors do you attract with the Super Museum?
We'll average out a couple hundred a day.
Not just during the festival. I take it the visitors will then be more during the festival.
Well, I mean, for the festival is a kickoff for our what we call our 90-day blitz, which is, you know, between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
And I'm wondering now, in Larry Tye's book, there's really a lot about the merchandising of Superman, and apparently DC Comics over the years has been pretty good at getting products out and getting...
Well, there's been a good level of communication and cooperation between DC Comics, Warner Brothers, and the Metropolis Chamber of Commerce. And so through the years, there have been developed merchandise for fundraisers and so forth. But Superman is a licensed character. It's a blue chip amongst collectibles. I mean, you're right up there with, you know, Betty Boop, Popeye, and the rest of them. But Superman has a special place in just about every facet of collecting and fandom.
When people come to the museum, are there any things that particularly attract them?
They love the costumes worn by the actors. Kirk Allen was the first Superman of motion picture, and he traveled with what I had as a mobile museum back way back when. We're just celebrating our 20th anniversary of being here in Metropolis, but before that, for 15 years, I had a mobile museum that traveled all over the country. And he would travel with the museum and talk about his role as Superman, sign autographs, and things like that. So we had a lot of fun doing that, but I was always in search of a permanent location for what I had collected, so that we wouldn't have to keep throwing it on and off the truck and giving it all that abuse and so forth. So, but we've been here in Metropolis 20 years. I'm from Los Angeles.
Okay, so you've settled down there after. Did you grow up on the West Coast?
Yeah, sure did. I was born in L.A., General Hospital there in L.A., and raised in that area there. And spent 38 years there before I decided to bring what I collected, 55-foot semi-truckloads of Superman.
And I was struck, you mentioned Kirk Allen. I was looking at your website, supermuseum.com, and you do mention that you were Kirk Allen's manager for several years. And just to expand, Kirk Allen started...
Lot of adventures there. He had so much fun reminiscing with the stories. I mean, he had developed Alzheimer's later on. But when it comes to Superman, I mean, those stories were so embedded in his mind that it was amazing to me that he had remembered so much of all that. And of course, he loved to interact with the people. He was, you know, just a great personality, and we truly miss him. He had always thought that he was going to be the forgotten Superman. And he had given me his phone booth that was given to him through some sort of a publicity stunt for the phone company back in L.A., and we had taken a phone booth and made a whole montage around it. And he sat there. He was invited guest here back in 1994. And he was a Grand Marshal of the Christmas Parade in 93. And he sat there in the corner on a stool with his girlfriend there and just said, well, you know, you kept your word. I'm no longer going to be the forgotten Superman, because everybody that comes in the museum knows that Kirk Allen was the first.
And I should note, Kirk Allen made two serials for Columbia in 1948 and 50. You can find, I think you can find them in their entirety now on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, they're on DVD, yeah.
On DVD and actually on YouTube online. So Kirk Allen is still out there.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the phrase long, strange trip that Superman has this attraction. Actors who play Superman sometimes worry about being typecast after they do the role, but at the
not so much anymore, because things are a lot more versatile then. I mean, if you look at some of the careers of the guys who played James Bond, Sean Connery and all that, they kind of broke the ice when it comes to the typecasting thing. But I'll tell you something, back in the 50s, George Reeves had a bigger problem with that than anybody.
And George Reeves came to a very tragic end shortly after that series went off the air.
Right, yeah.
But in the case of Kirk Allen, he sounded like someone who had really embraced the role.
Kirk Allen was an excellent dancer. He danced on Broadway. He was with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and he did a lot on the East Coast and New York and so forth in acting, and then went back to California and did a lot of commercial work. He got more commercial work than anybody I knew back at the time, because he was traveling with the museum in between doing all these other things, and he was always busy, always busy.
Well, Jim, I assume, is the Super Museum a growing collection? Are you still looking for things to add?
Oh, every day. Especially now with the new movie, we got the Henry Cavill playing Superman for the Man of Steel, and I tell you what, the buzz is just so positive on this movie. I mean, so much different than Superman Returns back in 2006. I mean, this is, they've gone over the top, they've taken the origin, and I mean, you know, like with the radio show, I mean, they couldn't find a guy sounding like Bud Collier, so they created this thing called Kryptonite and had a guy come in and moan and groan while Bud Collier was sipping Mai Tais on Miami Beach, you know? And that's one of those things where that's craziness is that, you know, it's one of those things that stuck with it and it developed and over the years, and all of a sudden Kryptonite became a very important part of the whole Superman legend.
Okay, well, Jim Hambrick, I wanted to thank you very much for talking with me today. And the Super Museum is open just about every day but Christmas out on the square in Metropolis, Illinois.
Right. Home of Superman.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
And Larry Tye, you've been to the Super Museum?
It wasn't open at the moment that I was free when I was at the festival, so I haven't. I've talked to Jim, and I think that The memorabilia collections are fascinating, partly because some of those things have no value, and others, depending on what you find and the condition it's in, you know, a vintage first issue of the June 1938 Action Comics can fetch more than $1 million, and then other things like the death issue in the 1990s when Superman was killed, they printed so many of them, nearly 6 million, that those are not worth probably what people paid for them then.
But all of them have apparently a strong sentimental value, if something else.
Huge sentimental values, yes, to fans who have stayed loyal for 75 years.
I want to take a moment. Jim Hambrick mentioned the new Superman movie coming out next week. I just want to play one of the commercials that's airing for that movie. This is the one that features Kevin Costner as Superman's foster father.
You're the answer, Clark.
Can't I just keep pretending I'm your son?
You are my son. But somewhere out there, you have another father. And he sent you here for a reason. And even if it takes the rest of your life, you owe it to yourself to find out what that reason is.
Rated PG-13. Experience it in IMAX 3D. Starts June 14th.
Yes, The Man of Steel opening next week in theaters everywhere. And I'm just thinking at the amount of emotional weight that just in that little TV commercial that they're working on attaching to the Superman story. That's a far cry from, the Superman of George Reeves.
It is. And yet the last Sunday, I was in Los Angeles doing a talk on Superman, and with me were Jack Larson, who was the original Jimmy Olsen from the George Reeves TV series, and Dick Donner, who directed the first and I think the best of the Chris Reeve movies, and Jeff Johns, who is the creative director today at DC Comics. Three generations of people from the Superman mythos over the last 75 years, and what they all shared, they told stories that literally made me cry about their passion for this character. Donner talking about, you know, growing up loving Superman and deciding to do the movie to basically rescue the character when he felt that the producers were going to destroy him. Jimmy Olsen, Jack Larson talking about being stereotyped as Jimmy Olsen and never being able to really escape that. And yet in the last 20 years, he embraced it and realized this is not a bad identity to have been a part of, you know, a mythos like Superman. Jeff Johns talking today what it's like trying to protect this cherished, you know, commercial as well as cultural icon in America. And it's just the Warner Brothers will not consider the movie that you just ran a clip of a success unless it makes north of $1 billion. But I think it will, because I think people, particularly today when the circumstances in terms of our economic stress and our overseas entanglement remind me of what was going on in 1938 when Jerry and Joe brought us the character. And I think today people will really embrace this impressive new Superman.
And that, you know, that raises issues. The first issue is, what is the Superman that is being presented today in this new movie, in the comic books that are currently coming out? And what is the Superman that audiences are interpreting?
So I think that's a great question, and I think it goes back to what we talked about a half an hour ago, which is the Superman has enough about him that is very contemporary and modern, the whole look of it, and the idea that he's being played by a British actor is sort of part of that notion of this new global figure, and yet it will only work if he also has enough of that little boy's invention of somebody to help him fight back against bullies, that thing that's sort of within each of us about somebody who knows instinctively right and wrong and knows that you can have a mild exterior and still be a really heroic character. And it's got to combine both of those elements, and I think it will. And I think Warner Brothers is smart enough to make it. In 2006, they came out with a movie called Superman Returns. It only made $500 million. It was considered a failure. Only half a billion,
exactly.
This one, they're determined to get right, and they really are convinced that it can be bigger than last summer's Batman or Avengers, and we'll see if they're right.
Right now, I have been watching a direct-to-video Superman movie, animated movie from, I guess, just about 5 or 6 years ago called Superman Doomsday, which I guess takes works with some of the death of Superman story elements from the comic books of a few years earlier. And what I was struck by is that there are things going on here that just would not have happened in the comic books are in the TV shows a few decades earlier. They were giving Superman an adult relationship. The violence, while it was still comic book violence, really counted for something since Superman is killed in the course of the story. I was just struck by what was going on in a movie which was actually, despite its PG-13 rating, being marketed to kids.
Yes, and in fact, it seems different, and it certainly is different, I suspect, than the Superman in the comic books than you and I grew up with. And yet, over the years, there have been so many comic books. They have tried just about everything. And Superman has been killed and brought back to life repeatedly, starting, you know, generations ago. He was married and divorced from Lois Lane repeatedly. Just about everything that happens that looks new when we revisit it, in fact, has got a history. And so I got calls from reporters from as far away as Australia and Canada and Britain when Superman quit the Daily Planet a couple months ago, and they were shocked and outraged. And the truth is that Superman has quit the Daily Planet repeatedly, whether it was to go to work for TV or whatever it was. It was part of, again, them trying to make him seem contemporary, or realizing that what you create in a fantasy world like comic books or movies, you can undo if it doesn't work and if fans don't like it.
Where is Superman being driven from these days? By that I mean, like for instance, the Superman I grew up with was the Superman in the DC comics of the 1960s. You identify Mort Weisinger as really being the driving force behind the comic books at that stage. But kids don't read comic books to the same degree, and when comic books are read, they're often read, I gather, more by young adults than by kids. And it's other media where people will really see Superman. So who's driving Superman now?
Well, DC Comics is still driving him, but in a way that's quite different than it used to be. It used to be that they were driving them because hundreds of thousands of kids were reading it, and those were the stories that people picked up on for other media. Today, DC Comics is out there in large part as an idea factory for movies and for other things. So a lot of the ideas are still coming from DC, but they're being done not with the notion that they're going to make their money by selling them in comic books, but by the notion that the new character that they're creating is a test marketing for media like TV and movies. And I think that a lot of the things that we've seen in TV shows, whether it was Lois and Clark or Smallville, and a lot of the things that we are seeing in movies like Superman Returns and The Man of Steel, the ideas are coming from the comic books with a very specific notion that they're testing them out, and if they work there, and if they sort of can sketch them out in a way that seems like a compelling storyline, they can try it in the audiences that Time Warner and Warner Brothers really care about, which are these mass audiences that can earn them $1 billion.
Which makes me wonder, do the comic books by themselves make money, or at least break even?
The answer is not really, and I think that they have a lot harder time, even with the extraordinary prices that comic books go for today of $3 and $4. I had dinner the other night with somebody who ran DC Comics for 20 years, and we were talking about it is a very changed world out there, and I think that partly it's an exciting world, and it's much easier to do things like make a man fly in a movie that really looks convincing. You can recall, I'm sure, in those 1950s shows, George Reeves was basically jumping on a trampoline, vaulting through a window, and being held up in the air with the wind machine blowing air behind him to make it look like he could fly. When the Chris Reeves movies came out in the 1970s, their marketing tagline was, "You'll believe a man could fly." And today we take it for granted that Henry Cavill will fly and look like he's flying. And it's just, some of the special effects are wonderful, but they can't do it just on special effects, and it's got to be on a heartfelt story, and they think they've got the story, and we will see in 2 weeks.
Despite the changed media landscape, you think the Superman story still has energy?
I think it's going to go on for another 75 years, because I think all the elemental figures, from a love triangle with two people to the notion that within each of us is a hero, those are still compelling enough notions that unless they blow it, this story has legs for a long time.
Well, we've been talking about Superman on today's Focus with Larry Tye, the author of Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. It's out in paperback from Random House. And Larry, thank you for joining us today.
It's been really fun. Thank you.
And our thanks to our guests from Metropolis, Illinois, Carla Ogle with the Superman Celebration, beginning today, running through Sunday, and Larry Hambrick from the Metropolis Super Museum, open year-round. Thanks to all of you for coming on Focus, and we welcome any additional thoughts that you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team, Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick, Jason Croft is our technical director. Tomorrow on Focus, will you really catch cold quicker if you go outside with wet hair? Is swimming after a meal really dangerous? My guest, Brian Utterman, will provide the answers to these questions and the truth behind other common bits of myths, misconceptions, and motherly advice. That's on Friday's show. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. This is Focus on WILL.